You're listening to audio from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where we train students to preach the Word and reach the world. For more free resources like this one, visit www.swbts.edu/media resources.
Well, Dr. Patterson, you are far too kind, too generous, and you exaggerate far too much. But I am delighted to be on the campus of my alma mater. And I love this institution, and it is a privilege indeed to be here. And to be here with Dr. Patterson is a special joy. And so today I am honored to present the Day Higginbotham Lectures at Southwestern Seminary. And the fact that you would come to listen today is you've blessed me by your presence. Now, before you fall off to sleep, thinking that we're going to bore you to death with the history of denominationalism, let me invite you to consider why we should look at a topic like this. Because there are questions abounding about the future of denominationalism in the 21st century. And will the patterns of the past serve the future? And will the new challenges call for new responses? These are important questions for you to consider as a future church leader and to recognize the moment in which we find ourselves, in which people no longer assume the importance of denominations. It is a big question today. There was a big study made 2 years ago that got a lot of attention about the nones, N-O-N-E-S, those who no longer had any identification with the Christian faith. That study from the Gallup poll said that one in every five persons in the United States would identify themselves as a person with no religious identity. 20% no religious identity, 19% an evangelical identity, according to that particular poll. First time that those numbers had been reversed and even been close to being reversed in that way. But there was a hidden number in that study as well that we often missed. And it said this: in 1990, about 250,000 Christians in America identified themselves as non-denominational, as faithful Christ followers, but having no denominational identity. But in this most recent study, over 10 million identified themselves that way. 16% in that study said that their denominational identity was important to them. In the same study, 21% said it mattered what kind of toothpaste they chose. So denominational identity is not nearly as important in the lives of some as it is for me, for you, and particularly for the Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas. And so we are here today to ask this important question and to do so from a historical vantage point. So in 1987, there was a publication by neurologist Oliver Sacks called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Dr. Sacks wrote about patterns within Korsakoff's syndrome, a neurological illness characterized by profound amnesia. Not knowing what they are doing at any given time or why these patients wander around in a state of profound disorientation. In losing their memories, they have lost themselves. And many think that American Christianity is on the verge of losing its hope and its identity in a similar kind of disorientation. The problem for many is not so much doubt, but a loss of memory. And the history of Christianity is best understood as a chain of memory, and we need to reconnect some aspects of that chain. And that's what I hope we can do today. And as Dr. Patterson said, today we're going to focus on the past, and tomorrow we're going to look at the present and the future. It's really a three-part presentation as we talk today about evangelical identity, denominational development and decline, as well as the future of theological education in the 21st century. Now, we're going to ask this question in light of the fact that we are here at Southwestern Seminary today, a denominational institution in which evangelical identity would be answered perhaps one way, and tomorrow, in which a lot of visitors come to campus for the meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, a professional organization representing numerous denominations and many in that group who would identify themselves as non-denominational. And so we're going to look at these three parts today. In many ways, the question of denominational identity, or whether it was important, began to be raised during the First Great Awakening. At that time, George Whitefield had these famous words that he uttered. When asked about what was his denominational identity, he said this, "Father Abraham, whom have you in heaven? Any Episcopalians? No. Any Presbyterians? No. Any Independents? Any Baptists? Methodist? No, no, no. Whom have you there? We don't know those names here. All here are Christians." Then forget those party names and become Christians in deed and in truth. The founding of the Biblical Institute of Los Angeles, which we now know as Biola University, R.A. Torrey established that school and said, "We are an institution that will serve Episcopresbyational Baptist." In other words, we're going to be a little bit of everything and not much of anything when it comes to denominational identity. C.S. Lewis said, "Our division should never be discussed except in the presence of those who've come to believe there is one God and that Jesus Christ is His only Son." Many people today would identify themselves as evangelicals because they read or identify with someone like C.S. Lewis or like someone like Billy Graham. Many people say that evangelicals are men and women who love Jesus Christ, love the Bible, love the gospel message, and who desire to cooperate in the work of missions, evangelism, education, and social ministry in service to the kingdom of God. Someone has even said the best way to understand what an evangelical is to define it around Billy Graham himself. For an evangelical is someone who likes Billy Graham. A liberal is someone who thinks Billy Graham is a fundamentalist. A fundamentalist is someone who thinks that Billy Graham is apostate. Well, that may be a way of orbiting your orientation today to think about the question of evangelical identity, particularly in light of denominationalism. Now, evangelical identity on the campus of Southwestern Seminary probably is answered today a bit differently in 2014 than it was when I was a student here in the late 70s and early 80s. At that time, there were some on this campus who identified evangelicalism and fundamentalism as one and the same. And when asked the question, "Are Southern Baptist evangelicals?" the answer was often no. As a matter of fact, Foy Valentine, who served at the Christian Life Commission, as it was called at that time, during that time period in the late 1970s, asked the question, "Are Southern Baptist evangelicals?" His answer was no. That's a Yankee word. We don't have Southern Baptists, we don't have evangelicals like that in the South. Well, I would say that there is a different way of thinking about that more broadly, particularly as Southwestern Seminary has an impact not only on the Southwest, not only on the South, and not only on Southern Baptists, but across the nation and literally around the world today through the Global Theological Initiative and your PhD program in World Christianity. Evangelicalism is a major part of the conversation here at this institution. So evangelicalism, as we look toward the conversation tomorrow, just so you know where we're going to be thinking about it as a cross-denominational movement. People who are heirs of the Reformation, influenced by Puritanism and Pietism, shaped by the 18th century revivals and 19th century mission movements. Largely, it's a renewal movement that countered liberalism, rigid fundamentalism, and dead orthodoxy. And so we're going to come back to this tomorrow. But here's a framework for understanding what we mean when we talk about evangelical identity, which is an underlying question when we ask tomorrow in the third session, what is the future of evangelical theological education? But we cannot talk about that, I do not think, without understanding the denominational context in which we live, breathe, and find ourselves during this particular time period in the second decade of the 21st century. So why look at denominations, you say? Because historically, denominations have been the instruments used of God to help men and women who think in organizational terms to provide structure for carrying forth three major things. Number one, the supporting and starting of churches. Number two, maintaining shared beliefs and practices. And number three, the enabling of shared work of evangelism, missions, education, and benevolence. There have been three broad traditions that have shaped our understanding of the Christian faith throughout history. Three major branches: Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and Protestantism. Eastern Orthodoxy, we would date breaking off from Roman Catholicism in 1054, for those of us who understand church history from the West, and Protestantism moving as a break off of Roman Catholicism in the early part of the 16th century. Prior to that, there were certainly different movements and different geographical representations among Christians, but they all found some rallying point in building upon the foundation of the early church councils, particularly Nicaea and Chalcedon, moving up to the place in which there were divisions over the understanding of the practice of Christianity, the leadership of Christianity, and key aspects of worship in 1054. So if you learn church history from the East, then this, your understanding of church history would look something like this, if we can get the next slide up, in which the history of the church is basically one of the history of Eastern Orthodoxy with breakoffs from Roman Catholicism, and then a breakoff of that in 1517 to Protestantism. So if you studied from the East, it would look like that. But if you learn church history the way most of us have done, from the West, then it would look this like this, with Catholicism, Orthodoxy breaking off in 1054, and Protestantism going a different direction in 1517. Context is important in how we even ask these questions and how we understand them. There certainly were various groups of Christians, as I mentioned, but denominationalism, as we now know it, as we talk about it today, can be traced to the 16th century, to the unintended Reformation, to a monk with a mallet who had no plans to start a new denomination, but because of his conviction about the Word of God, he led a movement that eventually broke from the Roman Catholic Church and began an unintended Reformation that continues even to this day. So by the time you get to the 16th century, you have four major movements that are starting: Lutheranism, Zwingli, which led to the Swiss Anabaptists, Calvin and the Reformed, and the Anglicans. Now, the Anglicans claim to be a third way, existing both before and after the beginning of the Reformation. But when you get to the 16th century and you understand the denominational picture, by this time, it's a little more complex. It's a little more clouded in how you see these groups starting to take shape, starting their own trajectories, and moving forward in different directions while still holding together around a commitment to a Trinitarian God and a belief of Jesus Christ as outlined in the councils of Nicaea and Chalcedon. Some recognize that fracturing was already taking place, and they called for unity, recognizing this fragmentation could be damaging to the witness of the gospel. There was already an emphasis on unity in the 16th century. Melanchthon and Bucer and others began to try to call people back instead of allowing them to go in their own direction. They reminded them of their commitments to the Nicene Confession, not only the commitments to the Trinity and to Jesus Christ, but to the confession that the church is one, holy, universal, and apostolic. It started slowly in the 16th century, but it gained momentum moving into the 17th century, particularly with the rise of Puritanism. Puritanism is the first major Protestant renewal movement. Their emphasis upon the purity of the church and focus on preaching and an emphasis on experiential Christianity gave them life, in which they wanted to change what was already becoming a form of dead orthodoxy or misguided directions as they understood it in the 16th century, just 100 years earlier. It's the framework of Puritanism out of which movements like the Baptists and Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Quakers found life and a place in which their beliefs and their commitment to church renewal and the purity of the church could take root and start in another direction. When you come to America in the 17th century, it is New England Puritanism and its commitment to Congregationalism that shapes American Christianity in the early days and becomes the foundation and the seedbed out of which various denominational groups soon develop. The emphasis on Congregationalism, particularly with John Cotton and Thomas Hooker and the three generation of the Mathers and others, cannot be ignored, but must not think that that is all there was to American Christianity. Swedish Lutherans in Delaware, the experimental movement in Pennsylvania, where William Penn referred to the holy experiment for all who believe in God, including Mennonites, Amish, and Brethren, and then, of course, the commitment to religious liberty that played out in Rhode Island, guaranteeing religious liberty to all the settlers led by Roger Williams and others. So by the time you get to the 17th century, with the renewal movement starting to take place, the denominational picture becomes a little more crowded, a little more complex. Just as before, if you learned church history in the East, you understood that in 1054, there is one way to understand the relationship between Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. Likewise, if you look at this next slide, you'll see that there is a different way of connecting the Anabaptists to the Baptists. For here I am at Southwestern Seminary, and if you learn Baptist history in one context, you might understand 1609 from one direction, but if you learn Baptist history in another place, you might connect the dots a little differently, as you see on that second slide. By the time you get to the 18th century, the Baptists are fully rooted, and you start to see the decline of Puritanism. 1700 to 1730 was not a happy time for Christianity in this country. In 1702, Increase Mather lamented the glory was departing from New England. The second, third, fourth generations of Puritans were unable to sustain the religious fervor of the first. But God stepped in, and a revival broke out in the 1730s and the 1740s with the focus around Jonathan Edwards in Northampton Church. Jonathan Edwards was certainly a scholar, theologian, America's greatest philosopher, but ultimately he was a congregational pastor, a revivalist, and for our purposes today, more importantly, an important interpreter of revivalism. The awakenings brought about differences in the churches, in groups of churches, in denominationals, in the denominations. It split these groups based upon the old lights and the new lights, those who supported the revivals and those who did not. The differences were not so much about theology as they were differences in forms of worship and preaching and the place of emotion in spirituality. There was a move that grew out of the first great awakening that moved away from a hierarchical view of polity and the church toward individualism and experiential Christianity. The rise of Methodism, both on both sides of the Atlantic, led by John and Charles Wesley, the great preacher, organizer, and writers of hymns. But these awakenings crossed denominational lines, so that in New England, the Congregationalists, in the Middle States, the Presbyterians and Reformed, and in the South, the Baptists and the Wesleyans were experiencing awakening in a similar way, creating a commonality in their Christian experience, regardless of their denominational stripe. Theodore Frelinghuysen, the Dutch Reformed pastor, Gilbert Tennant, the Presbyterian, and George Whitfield, who was a kind of Anglican, as we have seen already this morning, all would preach a similar gospel, a similar style, a similar approach to understanding of the Christian faith. Growing out of the First Great Awakening, there is a renewed emphasis on Bible and preaching at the center of the Christian faith. There is a new emotionalism that accompanies pulpit delivery. There is a movement, a place for lay itinerant preachers, and a shared commonality even with denominational differences, a shared commonality of the Christian experience. By the time you get to the end of the 18th century, by the time that this country had begun to take shape, the awakening themes were beginning to become secularized. The millennial themes were becoming nationalized. The postmillennial worldview, which was dominant among the Puritans, prepared the way for political revolution. And the war divided the churches as conflict came to the religious conscience of the new country, developing peace churches and those who supported the king and queen and those who could not. The beginning of the Second Great Awakening took place in the 19th century as movements coming out of the war, came along to bring about renewal, revival, and new emphasis of Christian faith in what was a very diverse understanding of Christianity coming out of the end of the 18th century. With the death of Jonathan Edwards and his closest followers, Samuel Hopkins and Joseph Bellamy, there is a move toward a New Haven theology, a movement from New England theology, which is largely Calvinistic, to a New Haven theology, which is a move that redefined Calvinism while battling Unitarianism, focused around Timothy Dwight and Nathaniel Taylor. With Timothy Dwight, the president at Yale University, he came to the place in which he said when he arrived, he could hardly find believers on campus. To 4 years later, almost every student that he had taking his Bible classes and his classes in moral philosophy was zealously sold out to the gospel. His revival had broken out at Yale University. Nathaniel Taylor came along after that and established the Yale Divinity School, largely to counter the Unitarianism that had dominated Harvard. Nathaniel Taylor's greatest student was Horace Bushnell. We'll talk about that tomorrow, which shows how quickly it is to move from one thought to the next, even within generations. But the great preacher of the Second Great Awakening was Charles Finney. He was a preacher unlike any of his day. He brought into play new measures, a different style, a different method of preaching, of revivalism. The task of revivals, according to Finney, was not only to the conquest of the opening door to the West, but the reconquest of the East Coast. And out of the Second Great Awakening, this attorney, philosopher, president, revivalist preacher developed the holiness movements, and then at the same time, simultaneously, you had revival movements in Kentucky at Cane Ridge, resulting ultimately in the restorationist movements. James McGreedy, Barton Stone, Alexander Campbell, all of these things were taking place. The West was untamed, and it was very different from the East Coast. But they had a shared approach that came out of the awakenings, whether it was from New York to Kentucky, across the country, among Methodists, Presbyterians, and Baptists, in which thousands were emotionally converted, brought into the churches through a common experience, and the common experience was soon more important than the denominational distinctives. All of these were renewal movements of a kind. And by the end of the 19th century, you can see that the denominational makeup is becoming a bit more cloudy and a bit more complex. As each group, which is a breakoff of something before it, tries to find its place within the Christian world. The restorationists couldn't find a way to get through on an off-tackle play, so they have an end around and go all the way to the other side, tracing their heritage back to the New Testament, they say. They were not a breakoff group of any kind or in any way. We should also note that these revivals were taking place among slaves and African-American churches at the time, and that is an important conversation worthy of an entire lecture, but it is important to note that we can really not talk about these things only within the context of American Christianity without recognizing what was taking place there. By the time you get to the end of the 19th century, the Second Great Awakenings had transformed Puritan covenant theology into evangelical democracy. Millennial vision was to convert the world not only to Christianity, but also to bring about democratic forms of government. The religious center of America had moved from New England to the Western frontier, and you had the rise of Methodists and Baptists, who now far outnumbered any other denomination. At the time of the Revolutionary War, Baptists and Methodists were just a little dot on the scene. By the end of the Civil War, the Baptists and Methodists were beginning to dominate American Christianity. How did that take place? Because Baptists and Methodists were uniquely suited for that particular moment. They knew how to mobilize. Their ministers were willing to preach anywhere, at any time, just as I know Dr. Patterson wants you to be able to do. The rise of lay preachers willing to endure hardship, to carry the gospel across any frontier. You saw the decline of Congregationalism and Anglicanism, which often was accompanied by a stale Calvinism, a variety new emotional Christianity on the frontier. And during this time, you also had the rise of Unitarianism and Liberalism, which we'll discuss tomorrow, and how that played out in the decline of denominations and how people had to respond to these new intellectual challenges. You walk into the 20th century and you have a very different look of Christianity than what you had when the Puritans dominated Christian thinking in America. By the time you get to the 20th century, there are a new spiritual movement that breaks out in Topeka, Kansas, and the Azusa Street revivals we point to as the Pentecostals and Charismatics. This new spirituality was not accepted by any denomination at the beginning of the 20th century. Fast forward 100 years to the beginning of the 21st century, and today they are the fastest growing group of any other denominational entity in the 21st century. All of these movements were hallmarks of revivalism in some way. They moved toward a transdenominationalism in which the revivalistic experience became more important than the denominational polity. And out of that, they all started parachurch groups, mission organizations, social ministries, and other movements. And the 20th century began to be quite complex in terms of its denominational identity. You can see from the chart how crowded it is. And all of those are just the big picture items. There are literally hundreds of varieties within each one of these groups. How then do we understand all of these different groups, all of these different denominations, and where do we find our place? Well, we've seen a little bit of how they have developed, but some of you perhaps do not understand quite the full impact of the distinctives of each one of these as more important than the commonalities in which they would share. For Roman Catholics, the emphasis on sacrament and tradition came to dominate as the way in which they could find a place within this broader sphere of the Christian world. Orthodoxy emphasized liturgy and mystery. Lutheranism, the word and faith. The Reformed Presbyterians, emphasis on the sovereignty of God. Anglicans on the worship and the Book of Common Prayer. Baptist on scripture, conversion, and baptism. Quakers on the inner light. Methodist, heartfelt religion. Holiness, piety, and separation. Restorationists, emphasis upon finding the New Testament church and bringing it to life. And Pentecostals on the power of the Spirit. That's probably a better understanding than the way they are often stereotyped, in which Lutherans are said to be Catholics who failed Latin. Episcopalians are Methodists who made it in the stock market, and Presbyterians are Baptists with an education. Well, I don't know about that at all. But some would view denominations as sinful and divisive and harmful, and therefore acknowledge them as unnecessary, leading to fragmentation. I don't think that is really the right understanding of denominations, for denominations are complex entities. Some of the developments were more sociological than theological, more geographical than doctrinal. Still, some theological emphases and differences are there, and they are very difficult to bridge. We need not ignore the fact that there are Calvinist denominations and Arminian denominations. There are millennial denominations and non-millennial denominations. But the reality is, it often has more to do with polity, liturgy, and worship than with what we might call first-order issues, which reflects how the differences started, even in the 16th century, between Luther and Zwingli. Some of it boils down really to how much water do you need? Do you need enough to dip, to dunk, to put all the way under, a drop, a dab? How much will do? Well, it's really a little more complex than that. But looking from the outside in, a lot of denominational differences are around how much water do we need and what makes up a real baptism. Yaroslav Pelikan has observed rightly, there is always a struggle then between understanding these intricacies between first and second order issues and between structure and spirit. We often don't give enough attention to the realities of structure and spirit in carrying forward the Christian movement. For you see, the spirit alone without structure, you'll wind up in aberrant movements. But when you have structure without spirit, you wind up with a deadness and a demise of the spirit in which the structure and the bureaucracy overcome the gospel. Denominations largely have developed as traditions have been challenged by new movements coming along. Those new movements, when they first broke onto the scene, were seen as a sect of some kind. But those sects grew up. They matured into a denomination, literally moving from the outcast into respectability, as we've seen from the charismatics and Pentecostals in the early 20th century to the place that they hold in Christianity around the globe today in the 21st century. How then do we understand all of these differences and still ask the question about evangelical identity? You see, because evangelicalism is largely a trans-denominational movement. It has largely worked around denominations. It has largely worked above denominations. It has occasionally worked within, but for the most part, it has been a renewal movement of independents and separatists, resulting in these new movements that came out of the renewal movements, all seemingly in search for a more pure and true form of New Testament Christianity. Evangelical identity is best understood as neither liberal nor fundamentalist. It is a renewal movement for Protestantism, grounded in a commitment to the truthfulness and authority of the Bible, to the uniqueness of the gospel, to the necessity of conversion, and to the need then for taking this gospel to the ends of the earth in forms of service and mission. Evangelicals have largely done this not through denominational structures, as we'll see in great detail tomorrow. They've established parachurch groups and mission organizations and all kinds of entities to help do that. But we understand evangelicalism largely as growing out of these renewal movements, out of revivalism that somehow runs counter to and often in competition to the denominations. And tomorrow we're going to ask the question, in light of understanding how these denominations have developed, if denominations are in decline, does it have an impact for good or for ill upon the evangelical identity and on the future of evangelical theological education? Evangelical Protestantism, then, has been shaped by Puritanism, by Pietism, by Revivalism. It opened the way and gave way to denominational proliferation, which in that sense, it's truly an American distinctive. Denominations, the proliferation of denominations is an American-made phenomenon. Unfortunately, it's often resulted more in the Americanization of Christianity rather than the Christianization of America. All attempts to bring state church to America have failed miserably, whether Episcopalian, Congregational, less so with the Presbyterians. The state church has not found a home in this country. And as a result, you've had the denominations proliferating as well as entrepreneurial groups. So today, we've taken a look at the history of denominationalism. We tried to understand how we came from the 16th century to where we are today in the second decade of the 21st century. The influence of these things on our contemporary context will be our focus for the morning address tomorrow, both in its American and global context, and then tomorrow afternoon to ask the question, where are we going? So I hope you understand a bit better how we got to this place. May God help us to have wisdom and discernment to navigate our way forward as faithful Christ followers who desire to serve faithfully the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ in this time for our generation. God's blessings rest upon you.
Thank you for listening to this audio from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you want more information on our academic programs, or if you would like to support our mission, visit www.swbts.edu.